I had to go through to eventually get the industry to talk to me. There's the ICMM, it's called. It's a International Council on Mining and Metals, I believe. And that's sort of an industry organization. They represent mining companies. And so speaking, I've spoke with them for a couple of articles, and they represent and have as their members many of the large mining companies, and they've said, hey, I can put a message out to our members to see if anyone wants to chat. But none of the mining companies really seem that interested in speaking with me, which is, I'm not trying to demonize them. What I'm really trying to do is find solutions to some of the problems that are very well documented and well known in mining. But yeah, I don't know that mining companies are very in the public eye, whereas fossil fuel companies, like you mentioned, Shell, you know, any of the big Esso or Exxon, the big fossil fuel companies are kind of household names.
Andrew Kaminsky is a sustainability writer and journalist. His pieces on mining can be found at triplepundit.com. Andrew, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Hi, I'm Michael Van Cleek. I'm tapped into the vibe and the rhythm of the river of the city of Portland, and you are too, because you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, as you know, which means we are funded by you, the listener. This morning, we discussed a new BFY book on Die Hard, followed by a commentary by KBOO's Matthew on Zatoichi the Fugitive from 1963. But first, here is Jeff Godsell to discuss a pre-code Hollywood film called Downstairs.
Most movie lovers are aware of the production code, Hollywood's self-imposed censorship apparatus installed in early 1934. And of the occasional flashes of nudity and general naughtiness in movies before 1934. But the intentions and effectiveness of the code goes beyond just revealing garments and saucy language. There had been an outcry from church groups and other do-gooders about violence and loose morals on the screen. Sound familiar? So to head off any government interference, the studios ushered in the production code. More than just a toning down on gangster films and the like, it ushered in a whole new set of standards of what could or couldn't be shown on the screen. Not only could crime never be seen to go unpunished, even married couples couldn't be seen to share the same bed. And if you sat on it, you had to keep one foot on the floor. Clever filmmakers and wily screenwriters were able to skirt these restrictions, just as they had done during the days of the Hays Office. But the guiding motivations for the production code were a return to traditional, read, paternal values. Not only could you not have any fun anymore, both men and women, but particularly women, had to maintain their traditional roles in society. No more women showing an independent spirit or being CEOs or even entrepreneurs. This kind of crackdown can and did have an insidious effect on any projects that explored any shades of darkness in society or any duplicity in the moral makeup of the characters. Which is what makes films like Downstairs from 1932 so fascinating. Made in MGM and starring John Gilbert, Downstairs began as an original story by Gilbert, who wanted to make the film so badly that he sold the story to the studio for a dollar. John Gilbert is one of the most fascinating figures in early cinema. One of the biggest stars of the 20s, his popularity rivaled that of only Rudolph Valentino as a lover on the silent screen. His films with Greta Garbo sparked an off-screen romance as well, prompting MGM to rename their adaptation of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina starring them to simply Love. But when sound films came in, Gilbert's popularity began to wane. For years, the myth persisted that Gilbert's voice was too high or whiny for the sound era. This is pure nonsense, as any viewing of his films will prove, including his last film with Garbo, Queen Christina, in 1933. The truth is that this gossip was planted, or at least perpetuated, by studio chief Louis B. Mayer. Their feud allegedly began when Mayer made a crude comment about Garbo and was punched by Gilbert. Nevertheless, Gilbert's salary remained high at MGM, and he had the complete support of the legendary producer Irving Thalberg. If his reputation sank with the early talkies, it was because of stinkers like His Glorious Night and Way for a Sailor. Now, things took a decided upturn with the delightful The Phantom of Paris in 1931, which brings us now to Downstairs. Downstairs opens with a wedding at the Baron von Bergen's opulent estate in Austria. But it is no one of royalty who is tying the knot, but rather the head butler, Albert, played by Paul Lucas, and the young housemaid, Anna, played by Virginia Bruce. During the ceremony, the newly hired chauffeur arrives, Carl Schneider. Carl, John Gilbert, soon finds an old acquaintance in the crowd, a former lover, the Countess de Marnac, who seems none too pleased to see Carl mixing with her new elite friends. It doesn't take long for us to discover that Carl is a cad. He wastes little time in flirting with the new bride, seducing the cook Sophie, and placing himself in an advantageous position to blackmail the Baroness. Now, Gilbert's natural charm is on full display here, but he also embraces the repellent side of Carl's character in a portrayal that is quite nuanced and unique among the mostly stodgy leading men of the early 30s. It is also a testament to the pre-code era to even have such a duplicitous character as a hero. There are a few more pre-code delights throughout Downstairs that keep this little gem interesting, and all of it moving at just the right pace for its 77-minute running time. Some of the credit must go to director Monta Bell. Bell is an interesting character in himself. Originally a journalist, he was enlisted by Charlie Chaplin to ghostwrite his 1922 memoir, My Trip Abroad. Hollywood beckoned, and Bell became an editor and eventually a director of several silents, most notably Greta Garbo's American debut, Torrent, in 1926. Bell seemed to specialize in sophisticated comedies and romances, prompting some to see him as a stylist in the Lubitsch tradition. But not unlike Chaplin, Bell didn't think much of talking pictures and chose to continue in Hollywood as a producer soon after Downstairs was released. Nonetheless, it's easy to detect a lightness in his touch, and Bell was clearly good with actors. Not only did he give Gilbert a free hand with his natural style, he coached Paul Lucas nicely. In contrast to Lucas's heavier typecast, like the mob boss that he had portrayed in Mamoulian City Streets just the year before. Downstairs is a blast and well worth your time, but hard to find. Fortunately, it has been uploaded onto YouTube in a very nice print, and you can find it there. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. And be sure to visit Jeff's website, Essentials of Cinema, for more film recommendations. Now, here is Matthew on Zatoichi.
Now, I really like a good series character. And one of the longest-running movie series is the Zatoichi, the Blind Swordsman series that first came out of Daiei Studios, and then the starring Sentaro Katsu as the Blind Swordsman. He later took the films appeared from starting around 1961 up until about 1970. They came out with about two or three of these movies every year. And after 1970, Katsu was able to move over to Toho Studios, and he did some like four or five more, and then a television series that ran for about 100 episodes. He came back in 1989 to do a final movie, and that was his series. There was a sort of attempted remake sometime, you know, around the 90s or 2000s, but I just want to look at the classic series. And and out of the series, you know, some of them are not too good, you know, because there's like 26 of them. But one of the best ones, it was about the fourth in the series, and this is called Zatoichi the Fugitive. Now, like I said, this is early in the series, and so the kind of narrative structure is very similar to a Western. A stranger comes to town. There's like two fighting factions within the town. The stranger shows to be of exceptional ability, but he doesn't take a side. The rancher's daughter, he may be attracted to him, but no, he kind of stays neutral. But the villains always give themselves away, and somehow or other they force the hero's hand into taking action against them. And that's kind of the basic narrative here in this movie, Zatoichi the Fugitive. Now, he's a fugitive because there's a price on his head. Now, he had lost his sight as a child, and he took up sword fighting because he resented people thinking that just because he couldn't see, then he was weak. And so as a young person, and he takes the sword up and he like becomes very proficient with it. And for a while, he's actually a sort of enforcer for Yakuza gangs, but he kind of grows out of that and becomes an itinerant wandering masseuse, like a lot of other unseen men would do, masseuses or acupuncturists or musicians. And so he would like get a way to spend a night in an inn or a week, and he would give either a performance or he would give massages. And that's kind of why Ichi arrives in this town. And so he is this exceptional swordsman. I mean, his hearing is really built up, you know, kind of like the Daredevil character in Marvel Comics. But this series finds Ichi on the road, and he travels from one place to another. So in this episode, Zatoichi the Fugitive, we've got this town where there's like these rival Yakuza gangs, and one gang has taken away the gambling house of the other, and the head of that gang is forced to just run a small inn with his daughter. The head of the victorious gang passes away, and now his son is now attempting to take over the running of the gang. And so there's this festival going on, and neighboring gangs are visiting. But this one guy, he wants to take over this guy because he senses weakness in the young man. And so he's going to connive with the other defeated Yakuza guy to house a swordsman that he's brought in, a Ronin, and his woman, and they're going to be put up there. And at some point, the robber guy is going to attack the young man's gang and kill them all with the help of the swordsman. But things sort of turn different because, like in a Charlie Chaplin movie, here Zatoichi like arrives on the scene, and it turns out that he'd had a duel with one of the members of the young master's gang, not a very important member or skillful member, but there was a reward on Ichi's head, and this guy just attacked him out of nowhere and would refuse to give up, and Ichi has to cut him down, even though he's saying, look, I'm so much better than you, don't attack me, I'll just kill you, but the guy does it anyway. And so he mentions his mother, who's in the Yakuza gang, and so Ichi has arrived there to let the mother know that her son is dead. Yeah, and so, you know, no good deed goes unpunished. And so this brings him into this situation. The mother, who's kind of a grandmotherly figure to the Yakuza members, she, at first, when Ichi says, well, I've got some news of your son, she, of course, says, what has that fool done now? And he tells her that, well, we had a duel and I had to kill him, but it was an honorable duel, an honorable death. And he had this money on him. And this is the money that Ichi had won. And he gives it to the mother, saying, oh, he had this money on him and he wanted me to give it to you. So he's really doing the good deed. And it's about this time that we find out that this visiting Yakuza gang are actually from a previous movie, and Ichi had killed some of their members and they're out for revenge. So there's a lot of nice introduction in this film. And later he goes to the other inn, and it turns out that the woman who's staying there with the samurai is an old lover of Zatoichi's from like two movies ago. And so it's wonderfully staged. I really like the plot, the nice use of wide shots where room for the characters to move around. And there's a lot of action throughout the movie, and it leads up to what's considered one of the best duels in not only the Zatoichi series, but probably a lot of the Japanese samurai films from this time. And this was like the height of the Japanese samurai films there in the early 1960s. Lately, you know, a lot of it inspired by the work of Akira Kurosawa. So I've been looking at the 1963 movie. There were like two other Zatoichi movies that came out that year in 1963. This was the middle one, the fourth in the series. A very nice, you know, there's tragedy, there's a lot of comedy. I love how the Dai-I Studios' films are so colorful in their historical period at this time. So really worth catching. You can find it on YouTube, Zatoichi, The Fugitive.
Thank you, Matthew. And you are listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland.
This is Professor Kitty from the Monday Sampler. Remember that this is listener-supported radio, KBOO in Portland. If this radio station is important to you, please go to kboo.fm/give to become a member. Now, back to Film at 11.
And here's a special announcement. Look for a special screen event from the Portland Critics Association to be held at the Hollywood Theater in November. The PCA is a group of local movie reviewers that dispenses Best of the Year awards, hosts screenings, and stages educational events. Go to portlandcritics.com for more information. And now, it's on to Die Hard. In 1999, film historian Kristen Thompson published her book, Storytelling in the New Hollywood, via Harvard. Her thesis was that the so-called New Hollywood had not abandoned as much of the old-style Hollywood as was typically perceived. Listing numerous still-current screenwriting structures and how the New Hollywood used them, one major innovation was to assert that the screenplays do not have three acts, but four act structures, each act about 20 minutes long, with an identifying transition usually one in which the protagonist makes a firm decision. This section is followed by a survey of 10 films, such as The Hunt for Red October, and notes that four parts, and notes the various tropes and instruments and their time code. This book should have become one of the top leading film books of the year, if not the following decade. There was a review in Creative Screenwriting, but otherwise little interest in the book from either the Academy or from the Writers Guild, at least that I could find. Ms. Thompson only mentions Die Hard a couple of times in passing, but John McTiernan's action thriller from 1988 could very well have been, and this is underscored by John Lewis's latest contribution to the British Film Institute's Film Classics series, which is a treatment of the film. As is customary in the BFI series, the film comes in at a brisk 100 pages or so and is divided into a handful of parts. An introduction with an unexpected personal note, a first chapter that elucidates the state of the nation at the time of the pre-911 European-flavored terrorism tropes, a look at the gender divisions in the film, and discusses the whammy theory of action films, which dictates that there be a big scene of violence or fistfighting or the sight of a car being decommissioned by bombs. Finally, in the last chapter, there is the undying matter of, is Die Hard a Christmas movie? There are also several interesting footnotes in the back, plus an extensive credit list. Professor Lewis's thesis, in brief, is that central character John McClane is wrestling with a redefinition of masculinity in the new ultra-corporate, more liberal or democratic, at least in those days, world where there doesn't seem to be much room for a do-it-yourself, bureaucracy-hating, authority figure-battling loner. He is, quote, working class, libertarian, objectivist, anti-authority, anti-intellectual, impulsive, and improvisational. That's on page 9. Further, quote, in its misdirection, a caper film promoted as a political thriller, Die Hard nonetheless expresses widely shared anxieties in the U.S. concerning international security, stability, anxieties rooted in a seeming decline in American prestige and influence that would eventually follow under the rubric The War on Terror. That was on page 7. Continuing, quote, Die Hard narrativizes redress for perceived post-war slights, for a decline in American international prestige, economic superpower status, and, after Vietnam, military eminence. Mr. Lewis writes, much as we recognize the formula, we welcome the fundamental promise that two conflicts, marital and criminal, will be resolved not in wordy arbitration, but in action instead. Die Hard is an American film, with violence being the most effective solution to everyone's problems. Action films, as well as political genres, the genres in play in the A story, work best when they seem realistic. The author tracks the film's production history, which started out as, of all things, a Frank Sinatra vehicle that would have been a sequel to his film, The Detective. And then Mr. Lewis summarizes the film's reception and lasting place in American culture. Professor Lewis also ties the link between something that happened to him on a flight from Europe to a stray empty refrigerator box blown into a LA highway that inspired the screenwriter at a crucial moment of stagnation. Chapter 3 is dedicated to the whammy theory, a notion attributed to producer Joel Silver and which dictates the frequency and content of action. He then provides a complete list of the 17 whammies to be found in Die Hard. This offers a good transition to some of the tropes and instruments that Kristen Thompson includes in her book. It's very much well worth reading in full. But here is the short version. Quote, Hollywood favors unified narratives, which means most fundamentally that a cause should lead to an effect, and that that effect, in turn, should become a cause for another effect. A transition to dangling cause and its concomitant issue closure. In short, everything is motivated. An unmotivated device is called a plot hole. Characters provide most of the motivations in any given film. Those motivations are based upon the traits of the characters, but if a character behaves in a way that is contrary to his or her traits, the classical narrative will offer an explanation. Further on motivation, Professor Thompson writes, the main character in a classical Hollywood film desires something, and that desire provides the forward impetus for the narrative. Hollywood protagonists tend to be active to seek out goals and pursue them rather than having goals simply thrust upon them, close quote. In other words, an active rather than a passive hero, of which there are too many. An impediment is usually a deadline, which she describes as often the protagonist in the former is under little time pressure to accomplish his or her goal. Furthermore, quote, Hollywood films tend to convey information about deadlines, character traits, and indeed any sort of story factors redundantly, quote. And then there's the rule of three. For example, in Silence of the Lamb, quote, similar information is given to Clarice by three different characters, conforming to the rule of three, commonly used as a guideline for exposition in the filmmaking community. Continuing to quote, within the scene, there is a host of stylistic devices that were created in the early years of Hollywood to achieve clarity. These include placing a distant framing of the action early in a scene to establish the locale and who is present. Close quote. Variety is offered with the use of the hook. Quote, leave a cause open at the end of one scene and immediately pick it up in the next. Such a transition is known as a hook. For instance, a famous transition in Tootsie moves Michael Dorsey from his agent's office, where he defiantly vows that he will get a job, to the street, where he appears in drag, thus revealing how he intends to go about achieving his goal. Close quote. She continues, frequently at the end of a scene, a character will mention that he or she is going to do and then will be immediately seen doing it early in the next scene. Such a line is a dialogue hook. Another variant is a character affirming that she is positively not going to do something, followed by an abrupt cut to the character shown doing the very thing she denied. Voice overlap is dialogue from the next cut overlapping the preceding scene. This is something only motion picture narratives can do, not opera or plays. Another means of providing temporal clarity, she goes on to write, from scene to scene and across stretches of narrative, is the appointment. The appointment may indeed act as a dialogue hook that reveals the time interval that the next scene transistor will pass over. Close quote. She writes, finally, a film can achieve unity and clarity by means of motifs. These can be auditory or visual. The phrase pop quiz hotshot in Speed helps to pull the elevator, bus, and subway segments together. It also provides a snappy means of exposition, as when the protagonist's answer to the first pop quiz is shoot the hostage. The five yellow barrels that Quint uses to try to control the shark in Jaws provide a splendid example of the virtuosity with which modern classical films can handle motifs. The barrels serve a surprising number of functions, close quote, and by the way, are shown three times. I might add personally, unnecessary arrivals and departures. French director Bertrand Tavernier shunned such transitions of, say, a person in a car arriving at a place, getting out of the car, walking away from the car to the front porch, knocking on the front porch, waiting, you wonder why some modern movies or TV shows seem bloated and slow-paced. The answer lies there. All of these instruments that Kristen Thompson has surveyed can be found in Die Hard. If you're academically inclined, picking up these two books would provide quite a fall term film filled with the gathering of cinema knowledge. Thank you for listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday. So until then, keep watching the screens.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
I'm Don Jacobson, one of the hosts of Moving On, here every Friday right after the noon news. Moving On isn't the only place to hear folk music on KBOO every week.